All of the views and opinions expressed here are those of the individual speaking and may not be representative of Coding American. At times, language may be considered vulgar. Listener discretion is suggested.
You are now listening to the Coding Behind the Wheel podcast.
Okay, we're live. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Behind the Wheel podcast. This is one of our Formula Drift editions that we do after each FD round. Today we're going to be running through some of the points and highlights from round four at Wall, New Jersey. I'm Scott, I'm the marketing director for Koenig Wheels. With me is Joey Redman. Joey is the founder of Rec Magazine and has been published in over 20 automotive magazines. Additionally, he has built SEMA vehicles for OEs like Hyundai and Ford. Additionally, you can find his 10 Things Learned article available on formuladrift.com after each FD round. So we're going to be running through some of those points that you talked about for Wall. And I guess we go right into number 10. Falcon Tires certainly bringing it in. They were 1 through 4, I think, right?
Oh, were they also 4th? You got me there. Look at you and your look at you off to an early start, stumping me.
It feels good.
Why don't I remember who finished 4th?
Hold on. I can assist you with this. Let's see here. We had Bocce's.
Oh yeah.
Right?
I forgot about that guy. Yeah. Yes. So Odie finished 4th. I don't know if that was the first time Falcon had ever all finished 4th. But
I don't know that either.
They did podium sweep way back when in 2009.
Right.
With, I think, 3 guys that no longer drive for Falcon Tire, interesting enough.
Well, you got 2 guys that don't really drive at all.
That is correct. Darren McNamara, Tyler McCrory, and Von Gittin Jr.
Right.
I don't even know how I remember that, but I was like, man, I feel like Falcon had done that before. Did a little bit of research. It actually took quite a while. And then there you go, found that. I don't know, like, I want to say, too, that was right around when the new 615K had come out. So it seems like there's definitely some benefit to that track and that tire for sure.
Yeah, I can't really say that I have the understanding and the ability to piece the two together, but the coincidence is certainly strong there. So going on to the next point, you talked about Ken Gucci. He's a veteran back on the rise. He's an extremely talented driver. He's been around for a long, long time. And he certainly, he looked really good.
Yeah, I mean, Ken Gucci is one of the original drivers in Formula Drift.
Right.
I think there's only 4 of those guys left. So, I mean, he's definitely in very exclusive company. You know, the thing with Gucci is, though, he's the only one of those, like, original drivers that's never really had, like, a really full come-out season. And I think that's tough, you know? I mean, I'm sure he sits and looks at some of these guys and is like, man, why am I not in that group? Because I want to say the Dai Yoshihara is the only other driver that's been there from the beginning who he's like has 8 wins, right? And so you look at the very next guy that's been there from the beginning is Gucci has 1 win. So like Ken Gucci's 7 win, like event wins away from like his second closest guy that's been around since 04. So
yeah,
it's tough for him, but like sometimes I feel like he's going to come out and do really good, and then other times he's a little quiet. The team seems to have a lot of car issues. So I don't know. I was just in general impressed with his performance over the weekend, especially that battle with Kristaps.
Right. I think what's interesting too is that you talked about they have a lot of car issues, but they've actually been developing that platform with Gretti for quite a while now.
They have, you know, I wasn't at the track this weekend in Jersey. And over the last year, I've definitely missed more events than in previous years, like when I was, you know, there for every event season upon season. But it does always seem when you're talking to Gucci or you're hearing him, the car seems to be chasing one issue or the other. They seem to have a lot of transmission issues, which obviously probably doesn't directly correlate to, you know, Gretti themselves, but it seems like they just, you know, I don't know if they make too much power or the suspension sticks too much, but he does seem to certainly have a lot of like drivetrain problems with that setup.
And I don't know anything about what he's got in there. I don't know if he's using a G-Force or anything like that. So
I don't either. I want to say he's got one of those air transmissions.
Oh, yeah, the pneumatic ones.
Yeah, but I'm not sure like brand type or if they've changed it or what that issue.
They certainly have the technology. It's not exactly like a team that is just trying to figure it out for the first time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe he can kind of come into form and snag maybe his first win or two of the season.
Right. So Matt Van Kirk showed up against Castro in top 32. This was a pretty good match for him. he not only shows that he means business, and what's interesting to me about Van Kirk is he, in my eyes anyway, has shown progression every single round. I mean, he looks smooth. He looks fluid. There's not too much hesitation on his part. Even if you look in the areas where he tries to maybe straighten up a little bit and try to drive forward to make up some distance when, you know, just because of the lack of power, essentially, he does it in a way that doesn't make the car look jerky. He's smooth about it. He's committed. I think that might help him in some of the judging points, but he had a really good round against Castro, and that drove him to a one more time. And then they came back for that one more time, and I think he drove a really solid round, and kudos to them for being able to have that point where they picked up a win, because remember, their last top 16 came by a bye.
Correct, against Esso was unable to make it to the line.
Right, so...
Yeah, I think Van Kirk did really good. I think winning his first top 16 was awesome. I think he was pretty respectable against Odie. I do think, however, at some point this season or early next season, they're going to find themselves in the situation where if they want to, I think, continue on this path, they're going to need more horsepower.
Yeah.
You know, I think right now he, by a long shot, is the strongest driver in the rookie class.
Yeah.
But I look at a guy like Dirk, who I think he's only 16, 20 points like ahead of somewhere in that ballpark. I think Dirk has a more prepared car. So, you know, you run into that balance, right? Like, I think Van Kirk's probably got the better team, the better setup, but he's never going to be in a situation where he's going to be able to beat a guy like an Odie, for example, without Odie messing up because Van Kirk lacks the power to keep up. I think looking back at that battle, like, that was the only difference. Like, yeah. He, you know, Van Kirk didn't seem to be fazed by, like, competing against the bigger name. I even look back to Osbo, not saying he could have beat Osbo, but without horsepower, he doesn't really stand a chance, I guess.
Right. Well, so what's interesting is I actually made it out to Wall. I had a lot of time to go hang. And I do mean I had the pleasure of hanging out with Van Kirk and the team. When you really speak to them, you realize how much they really want it. And I think that's a great thing. I don't know where I stand on the whole, you know, Van Kirk skill level compared to Dirk right now. I think that they're probably close. They just have different driving styles. I do think it's interesting, though, if you look at a car, the Corvette that maybe, you know, it's a stark contrast between, you know, Field and Dirk and his vet, just because, I mean, like, Dirk still has, like, full interior. I mean, you talk about a consistent, reliable vehicle. Dirk's team definitely has built that because the Corvette out of the box is pretty reliable, you know? I mean, it has full interior and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about that. I had a lot of time to spend with Van Kirk. They're fighting really hard. I believe that they understand about the power issues. It's not something. I believe that next year, if their plan remains to continue in pro, they will address that and go to something that's totally different. I don't know about totally different platform wise, but as far as the horsepower situation, I think it's one of those growing curves that you have of transitioning a program from pro 2 to pro in a short amount of time without necessarily, you know, you don't want to change the platform because that can get really difficult. You lose the seat time. You don't have, you know, all the driving time that you need to progress a platform in a short period of time. And it is really short. I feel that also, you know, they got it stuck in that thing of financial. It's hard to bring a program without having a lot of financial backing, you know, change the power level and get the seat time in, you know, as quick as they had to make the jump. So,
yeah, I mean, for sure. And I mean, with horsepower comes money and breaking other things, reliability. I mean, looking right back to that same issue, I think we're talking about with Gucci, like, I think that team probably just struggles finding that balance of giving Gucci enough power he needs, but without breaking everything every 5 minutes. And, yeah, you know, I think once you're ready to play with the big boys, unfortunately, that's like one of the biggest factors or, I guess, challenges you're constantly trying to fight.
Right. Justin Pollock showed up with guns a-blazing. He had a really good qualifying score. I think he had a 95. His first was 92, second was 95, something like that.
Sounds right, yeah.
And he came out. He looked really good. It was Justin Pollock that on his bye run that lost the drive shaft, shot it out of the car. Does that sound right?
That is correct, yeah.
So, interesting enough, really, really good thing that that happened during the bye run, because if it didn't, and it was a competition, you know, if he was, like, you know, head-to-head with somebody, that could have really changed the outcome of his day, because he finished third.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's funny that he's qualified now first twice in a row. He qualified first in Atlanta and actually lost to Gucci in his first event, which, if you pull up the championship standings real quick,
yep,
Pollock is 98 points out of first place behind Dean right now. But he took a big hit. I mean, he only scored 32 points in Atlanta. I think if he could have maybe duplicated that with another third place, I mean, he's all of a sudden in fourth, like kind of knocking on Forsberg's door. So, you know, I think, I guess looking at the 2 points that I had colliding, 7 and then back to 9, like both of these guys are really coming on the up. And I think it was unfortunate they met so early in Atlanta. But I think maybe we keep an eye out and see if those guys bump into each other again soon.
Okay. So moving on in the points thing here, Matt Field certainly laying it out there.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. There was this shift I think we saw with him Thursday in practice. In Atlanta, he crashed.
Right.
Smashed the wall. I think his hatch flew like over the K-rail into like the fan
right
area. But I think that helped him in a point. Like it just seemed like it just made the car more his own. And so he really showed it. I mean, he just came out and he kicked a lot of butt, I think, over the weekend. There wasn't really a battle that I felt he could have lost until he met Dean. I mean, he dominated Jeff Jones. He beat Turek even pretty convincingly. He wasn't very troubled by Forrest.
Right.
There was a little bit of, you know, maybe controversy in that battle we'll touch on later. That's a kind of a separate point of the 7 driver.
Sure.
Him and Pollock was probably one of the best runs of the weekend. And, you know, he managed to beat Pollock as well. So James Dean's James Dean. I mean, he's always going to be on James Dean's best day. He's going to be one of the toughest guys to beat. And Field just kind of ran into him on that day.
Well, and I'm sure that if he does listen at any point or anybody sends him the message that we're even talking about him, maybe he'll appreciate the fact that you didn't bash the crap out of him this time.
I mean, I don't feel like I have. I mean, he might right. have a different opinion, but...
Well, no, I think you've been fair. I mean, we don't have any bias really towards anybody to swing anything. We're just kind of going through what everybody else is watching too, but...
Yeah, totally.
You were waiting for a match that didn't really pan out. That was the Ward House.
I know.
It was so close.
It was close. If you look on my, if you ever visit my top 10 things on the Formula D site, it actually, the screenshot, or I guess the photograph taken by Larry Chen that's like posted with that photo, I think says everything you need to know. I mean, these guys are on the bank, touching wheel to wheel, you know, basically kissing headlights and bumpers.
Right.
In a part of the track where you don't even normally see people close to each other in reality. So it was all stacked up, I think, to be the best battle in Formula Drift history, perhaps.
And then, dun-dun-dun.
And, you know, maybe put your conspiracy theory hat on and say one driver took the dive. The official storyline from the team, or at least as James Dean said it, is that Pitiora's car went into, like, a safety mode with the right. ECU because it got too hot, kind of shut down, and they were unable to finish. But I really hope to see that as like a rematch before the season ends.
Right. So this was, Wall was the official 100th event that Formula Drift has thrown, which is it's kind of wild to think about it. When you think about, you know, 7 to 8 rounds a season, that it's been around for that long already, to me it almost feels a little bit like in its infancy, not too long ago, but it really has been quite a long time. And just, I think we touched upon that last time with the progression. I think it's all stacking into place to really legitimize them as a really tangible, you know, race series.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, I didn't realize that the series had been around that long, actually, right. event-wise. But if you go back a couple episodes ago, I was kind of touching on, like, the different segments of Formula D, you know. Yep. I was like saying, yep, there was, and it's funny, I had 4 different segments, so like you probably could almost separate those maybe into like 25 event like blocks, right? Like this is how this happened, that happened, you know. So It's pretty interesting. I really wanted to pull a lot more data from my Formula Drift story on this. I did kind of get a little bit of a time crunch as I was traveling around the world while trying to get this done. But I found some interesting things. You know, 27 drivers have won an event who, interestingly enough, are also from 11 countries. But I think that shows to me something that maybe drifting has that, like, say, import drag racing never really managed to do is, I mean, if you want to say, like, I do hear people sometimes complain, like, oh, I don't pay attention to Formula D because the same guys win every event.
Right.
But when you look at it, 27 different drivers have won, and there's only been 100 events. So, I mean, that's one out of every four events you're getting a new winner, like a totally unique victor. And I don't think you have that kind of odds in Formula One. I don't think you have that kind of odds in NASCAR. I think even NHRA these days, you're not looking at out of every four events, some new guy's winning a race that's never won a race. So I thought that was probably one of the most interesting things I took away when I was trying to dabble with the data, is just that there's a lot more people that have won an event per how many events there are than I think you would imagine.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I think your point is interesting. You really see the global effect on the sport as a whole, whether it be from a grassroots perspective to then trying to make it. And there's plenty of other countries that have their own series, you know, right? The European Drift Series and stuff like that. So as a sport, it really is very popular globally.
Totally.
And Formula Drift has done a very good job, to their credit, about becoming the extremely dominant series recognized all over the world, and doing a job to pull in some of the better talent pool throughout, maybe not all in one clip this season, that season, but over their longevity, I think they've done a decent job about pulling that talent pool over, which at least recognizes them as being one of those series that is, you know, the authoritative stance on drifting.
So, I would agree.
So Wang had a little demolition party, as you wrote?
Yeah, I think I'm only going to touch on the second part of it, mostly because, or you know what, let's just combine, I think, that point and my other point, and Judge is showing some consistency.
Yeah.
So starting with this, basically, this is how it kind of went down. Frederick Osbo and Forrest Wang met up, and Osbo, who I think, unfortunately, of all the bigger name drivers, I think might have a reputation for not always being on the gas when he's supposed to be, let off in on the bank, which is technically considered an acceleration zone.
Right.
And so it was really hard to tell, to be honest, in the footage. I could have really gone either way, as much as I want to be one of the first guys to be like, you know, look at Osbo and his, you know, tricks over there. It was tough. I would have liked to have seen perhaps some different angles, or maybe like a GoPro mounted on the banking. But, you know, for whatever reason, we didn't have those options. But the judges put the line in the sand and said, look, like, the reason Forrest Wang hit you is because you're supposed to be in forward momentum and you weren't. Yeah. So therefore, he's trying to stay close to you. And if you're not in forward momentum, obviously he's going to hit you. So I see where they came to that conclusion. You know, Wang smashed up his car and then advanced to battle Matt Field. And then it was kind of the same issue. Like, it was actually very reminiscent of 2 years ago. Wang came off the bank, dialed in a ton of angle, got off the gas a little bit. Matt Field smashed into him, which then resulted in the same exact issue. It was not a deacceleration zone. By Field hitting him, the judges, I think, were consistent in the sense that they said, look, you know, you're not in forward momentum, in a forward momentum area. You've been hit. It's your fault.
Right.
I think some fans might not agree. I'm sure one of the drivers, Forrest Wang in particular, right, probably doesn't agree.
Right.
But, you know, I think it was the right call. It was a hard one to be made. But I think Formula Drift would have looked way worse if the decision was not made the same way, with both instances being the same. Like, if for some reason they would have faulted Field in the second one or Wang in the first one, you know, however that came about, whether you agree with the judging or not, I think what everybody wants from the judging in drifting, not even in Formula D, just I think drifting as a whole, is you want consistency. Right. You want to understand how the judges came to this conclusion, and you want to be able to anticipate the next time this happens, you're going to get the same result.
And consistency is something they've done a very good job at. If you look about, we talk about the evolution of the series, but if you would look back at the evolution of how the judging was done and what their criteria was from start to finish, that has evolved immensely. And I believe that if we talk about like the view, having another view on the bank to kind of see that deceleration, but the one thing that I'm hoping that they're reviewing, because they put a rule into effect, was the wheel and tire marking rule. Like now, now they have to, you know, for Formula Drift, now all guys have to either run the tire stickers, run some sort of marking. I don't know if there's a mandate as far as it, how long or wide that, you know, coloration on the tire has to be if you don't run tire stickers, but there has to be a mark there. There has to be a mark either that or on the wheel. You know, that's why you'll see some of the guys with the colored spokes. That's not a fashion statement. That's there. So they have the potential to be able, or the opportunity rather, to be able to slow that footage down and be able to watch and see if the wheel starts to go slower. I believe that's what that's there for.
Yeah, totally. I think just to wrap this up before we move on too, I found it really interesting in the post-interview with Wang. He touched upon his incident with Forsberg.
Right.
And which happened 2 years ago. Forsberg ran into him coming off the bank. And he kind of implied that it was very much, he didn't quite say it was like
his fault,
100% correct. But he said like the judges made what they would be a right call. But then versus Field, which to me, I feel like they were very similar incidents. He referred to it as, and I quote, a fine line. And he also said that it could have easily gone either way. So it was just very interesting to see his perspective and like what I would consider was two similar incidents to a point.
You know, it's interesting, but the one thing that we don't know, one, because we've never driven in that kind of capacity. You know, it's interesting when you are the one performing and when you're in that moment, how you necessarily perceive what your own actions were. I mean, remember, they're not getting a chance to go watch the live stream or to see themselves at that point. They're coming fresh off the moment and to recall exactly where they may have been. I mean, there's sometimes where it's intentional or it's part of a strategy or they know what they're doing. And in that case, you would say, no, they knew, they were fully aware. But there's plenty of times that if it's just something that occurs, you may remember it or recall it differently in the heat of the moment. I mean, and that interview happens not too long after after that actual run took place. So, you know, I want to give some people the benefit of the doubt. Maybe, you know, when we talk about the whole thing about referring back to 2 years, maybe it was something he clearly remembers and recalling as maybe partially his issue. Maybe the other part is that he's had the opportunity of watching that over and over again from a different perspective and kind of coming to terms with it. I'm not sure.
Maybe. That was just, I think, something that just caught my attention. That right. He obviously clearly felt they were different scenarios or, you know, different opportunities, I guess. That is a valid point. Like, he obviously is just coming straight off the hot take. He also did, I think, that I didn't quote him in as saying that, you know, he had been driving like that all day, which maybe then you would think that's something his spotter, one of his guys, is, you know, trying to help him tweak or improve upon.
Right. Well, and on a random side note, there was a little Wang versus Wang early on when Dean Kearney borrowed Forrest Wang's demo car after Kearney suffered a mechanical where I think the engine locked up. So so Kearney jumps into essentially a mirror imaged or appearing mirror-imaged S-15s to do their battle. And, I mean, I was only cosmetic. They lost a few bumpers, nothing crazy. You know, Kearney blew one of the clips and did some stuff there. But that was kind of weird to watch. When I was watching the back, I was like, wait, who's on the lead? Who's on the chase? You know, I had to double back for a second. So
yeah, that was pretty funny, for sure.
James Dean, ultimately having a good day, pulling it out, really showing that, don't worry, haven't left, still here.
Yeah, I mean, he's another one I think that team had started to really chase some
mechanical
car issues. He actually hadn't won an event since Texas of 2017, so he almost, I mean, he was getting to the point where he was almost looking at a whole year without a victory, which seems not that big of a deal, but when you consider he won his first ever event, his third ever event, his fourth ever event, and sixth ever event, I guess, of the season. I mean, I know back in like 2009, he ran a car and everything. But since his like return and like his own proper program, you know, he was basically averaging every other event he was in as a win.
Right.
So he kind of went on a cold streak. I think he had the rest of the field breathing easy, but now he's jumped back into the championship. You know, I think it's all eyes on Osbo and Forsberg to see if they can catch him. I mean, one of the only other guys I think that really, if you really want to extrapolate out, I think Pitior has a chance, and maybe JTP, but JTP really is going to need a lot more number one qualifiers and, I mean, some more podiums to really catch up with this amount of time left.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard going back to something that we said we would address after each episode that we do here. That spread has consistently, you know, we talk about that quite a bit, that podium spread, once it kind of starts to get decently pulled apart, it's a tough thing to overcome. So Dean's back in one, like you said, Osbo, Forsberg, Pollock. I mean, you're still talking about, you know, 98 points, 87 points for Wysak down. I mean, that's a lot of ground to make up.
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot of ground. I mean, it's obviously mathematically very possible.
Right. I mean, we're only at halfway.
Point. Yeah. But I mean, these guys got to look at basically earning an additional 30 points a round. So, I mean, for Pollock to win, he needs to basically finish about 25 points ahead of Dean for each event of the year. And then a little bit smaller gap for the other drivers. But I mean, yeah, basically, he either needs some of these other drivers to really screw up, or he needs to be like podium, which I think both are possible, but it was, I don't know. I definitely think you've got some of these guys, Osbo and Forsberg in particular, now that Dean's back in like a winning way, like now that he kind of is like back in action, I think it could be, you know, you could be looking at the Dean repeat.
Just so people know, can you give him a little insight as to exactly how these points are distributed?
Sure. So you were given 32 points for a top 32. You were given, is that right? Hold on, that doesn't sound
right.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't
think. It's 16 points for top 32. And then basically those first groups jump by 16. So if you make top 16, it's 32. Then you go to 48.
Right.
If you're third or fourth, you get 64 points. It doesn't differentiate just because there's no battle. So regardless of if you finish third or fourth, 80 points for second and then 100 points for first. So the difference of third and first is actually pretty significant when you're talking 100 points, 64 points. And then qualifying, you get 7 points for qualifying first, and the points slowly degrade down. And I think once you pass like 16th place, you basically just get 1 point.
Yeah, it's interesting. Is that 2 points?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, yeah. 17th to 32nd gets 2 points.
Right.
Well, it's actually, it's like one qualifying point because everybody gets 1 point one for point. Attendance. So it's a little confusing. But
right.
Yeah.
And if you, right. And if you, for attendance, but more or less, if you DNF, it's not just about showing up. I mean, you have to actually make it to the grid.
You do have to make it to the, you know, I don't necessarily know where the attendance point comes in, to be honest.
Right next to the participation trophy?
Maybe. I think as long as you, I mean, we're really getting down to semantics here, but.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah. I could ask one of the Formula D guys, but I think as long as you make a run, you're going to get your attendance point.
Right. I'm trying to remember what Austin Meeks did because he was there in New Jersey for his qualifying.
He did make some runs, didn't he?
Yeah, but I don't remember if they were practice runs. I don't know if he ever made it into qualifying. I just don't remember. So it's not a fair assumption. I don't want to throw that one back. And honestly, it doesn't matter. We're talking about 1 point. I'm just, I just wanted people to have an understanding of exactly. You know, the hearers talk about these points. They may seem a little untangible without having an idea of where they come from. So I just figured it would be a good spot to segue through that.
Got it. Yeah, so I mean, just if you want to think about it, a perfect weekend for a driver is 107 points. So if Justin Pollock shows up in Seattle and has a perfect weekend of 107 points, and then Dean, for some reason, breaks on Thursday and never competes,
right,
Pollock could pass James Dean in that amount of time. Right. So that's, he's basically one full event away from beating him, which, you know, could be done over the next four rounds in small pies, or he could make, you know, I guess one big jump.
Right. All right. I think we've run through all the points. Anything you want to add from Wall?
You know, there's something about that track. Like, I hate going to it. Like, I don't like being in the middle of
it's a smoke ball.
New Jersey. In general.
sorry to everybody that's listening from New Jersey, but I share that sentiment, and I'm from New York, so.
Listen, I like New Jersey. I just don't like where that track is in New Jersey.
It's kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, like, which I didn't know there was a middle of nowhere in New Jersey until I went.
It's Wall,
to,
New Jersey.
To Wall? Well, yeah, I don't know. I just assumed that all of New Jersey was either the shore, Atlantic City, or a New York suburb before I went to Wall.
Yeah, I mean, they have some other parts, but...
anyway, all that aside, I just... There's something about that track and the events that are really, like, exhilarating or exciting. Like, it's not a perfectly built track, but it works. And it's one of the only... You know, original Formula Drift tracks. Granted, they left for one season and went to Englishtown and then came back. But
yeah,
I mean, I
think that there's a possibility that it won't be there all that much longer. Not because of anything Formula D did. I think that track in itself has been struggling on and off with some potential issues. And the problem, I think, with moving it to E-Town becomes the paddock area and where, you know, some of the vendor midway is so segregated from the grid. That road course that they use really offers a ton of distance. So I think that is one of the major things that they've kind of had an issue with. So I don't know if they'll end up moving in at some point in the next few years. But Wall itself is an interesting place. It's a really steep bank, probably the steepest of all the bank tracks that they attend. It's a short bank, so it's not as long as Irwindale, right? No, it's not.
It's not, yeah. It's a... It is significantly smaller than Irwindale, though, whatever sizing is, yeah.
Yeah, and so this year they made a few changes. I know that they on the K-Rail, if you'll notice, they'll have some black panels that they have in there. And I think that was a stop some of the drivers previously from having issues where contact, that K-Rail would be a little rigidy, and depending on how you hit it with the car, could potentially flip the, you know, turn the car around quicker back into the K-Rail. We saw that with Nate Hamilton last year. We've seen that with a few other drivers. So I think that was good. It allows them that touch and go surface like OSW has. If that green area, if you watch, you're watching, they have those panels to keep you from having those jagged edges where a small tap on the thing instantly drive can spin the car or grab the car in different locations depending on how you hit it. So that was good.
They ended up pulling them off though before Saturday.
Were they all gone?
Yeah, so I don't. From what I was told, overnight they removed them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that was one of those things. They had suffered some hits in practice and in qualifying, so I don't know if that maybe was just because out of irrepair, or if there was some issue there, and they just felt that they were more harmful than helpful at that point. I'm not really sure.
I'm not either. I would imagine that the drivers were probably involved with that decision in the drivers' meeting. Like, they probably voted on Friday night. I probably should have asked. That wasn't in my notes to bring up this weekend, so I didn't. But
fair.
If we get some feedback and people are curious, I've got no problem doing that. And then real quick, before we go,
yeah.
I did some research while you were chatting.
I love that.
And Wall Stadium is a 1/3 mile bank, and Irwindale is a 1/2 mile bank.
Okay, that's sizable.
Yes. Yeah, so they definitely do offer very different... challenges, I guess.
Right.
Even though they're both ovals.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Wall's cool. I mean, if you can deal with the fact that the smoke doesn't seem to dissipate. You know what's interesting? Real quick, I know this is kind of completely random, but the one other thing that I've been talking about, we're going to have some more podcasts coming out. We're even doing some shorter, quick format versions of some random interviews that we've been doing. So I had a chance at Wall to run in with Kevin Lawrence. We ran in with Van Kirk and also with Coral Works and Ryan Littoral. And
cool.
Some of the things that kind of kept coming up, and this is something that we can expand upon at a later date, when asked about the jump that they're making between Pro and Pro 2, one of the things that seemed to come up for every single driver, unprovoked and unasked, was the smoke line. And I think that's... really interesting, and we start to address it in each one of these things. So stay tuned. If you're listening to this, stay tuned for some of the quick shifts that are coming out. I think I just put up Ryan Littoral last night, so that was, I think, Saturday. So we're going to have a few more of those coming out in the next week or two. The smoke line has been one of those things that I don't think I've ever even thought to ask about, and they all brought it up, which is one of the things in their adjustment between Pro and Pro 2 is the fact that that smoke line is so intense on Pro because of the amount of power and how much they're putting out, that when you get lost in it, when you don't have a good proximity to the car, especially on the chase run, that smoke is almost blinding. It's disorienting. You lose place and you have trouble making ground up because you're not sure where the car in front of you is. And I thought that was absolutely like something that's really, really interesting. And I would imagine that that's got to be there. And I'm surprised it wasn't, but I would think it would be there from Pro-Am to Pro 2. But I think the reason it's not, and Matt Van Kirk talked about this, is because in Pro-Am to Pro 2, Pro-Am varies quite a bit. And depending on which series you came out of, the power cars that you went up against theoretically were sometimes as great as the Pro 2 car's average. So you might not necessarily have a difference in what you're used to there, but as soon as you jump in from Pro 2 to Pro, that smoke line certainly is tangible, visible, and violent. And that's no difference. That's the reason I believe that they went from, you know, Walls had two different configurations. One is that kidney bean thing, and then this is the one they returned to, which happened this year. I believe one of the reasons, I heard this from somebody, but one of the reasons they had done that was because of the amount of smoke that happens in that infield section. And once you add in some of the sun, it becomes blinding. I think I actually heard that on the live stream from some of the Driftcast guys, you know, Sam and them. So credit to them. Corey Hosford, I think, was talking about it, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely not a shortage of smoke these days.
No, and at Wall, it doesn't. And at Wall, people should understand that oval is kind of sunken into the ground. You walk down into the stands at Wall. It really is. The smoke just doesn't dissipate when you're there in person. It's almost at some points, especially going into that chase run. Sometimes it can be absolutely blinding to the point where you can't really see the cars up where on the starting line, which is that far area, that far bank away from you from the stands. So you realize how difficult that can be. You add in some of that smoke plus the smoke line of the driver in front of you, you lose a little proximity, and that all of a sudden is another factor that can easily make that track more difficult to drive at.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think we've run through it. Are you good?
I'm so good.
All right. Joey, thanks for the insight and the time as always. Why don't you tell people where to find you out there?
You can find me on Instagram at Joey Redmond, R-E-D-M-O-N-D.
Sweet. All right. That's it for this one. For more info on the podcast, head over to KoenigWheels.com/podcast. You can also catch us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at KoenigWheels USA. If you like what we're doing here, please go ahead and subscribe. We're on iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. That's it. We're out of here. We'll catch you next time. Peace.